Our visiting speaker will give this evening's Dhamma talk. And while everyone is getting themselves comfortable and the latecomers are coming in, just a few words about Hajjanyana. He was born in Adelaide. And I remember some of the stories he told me about his early life. The one I remember was when Gough Whitlam got kicked out of being Prime Minister by the Governor John Kerr. I think John Kerr visited Adelaide University, and he was one of the chief student activists. Almost got himself arrested by ACO. But having protested for the freedom of democracy, then he started protesting for the freedom of the heart when he went over to Thailand to become a monk with Ajahn Chah. First of all, he actually became a monk in the south of Thailand, I think, a novice monk, and then he found Ajahn Chah. And he's been a monk now for 27 or 28 years. 27 years as a monk. So that's, well, I was going to say longer than many of you have been born, but I look around me and say, no, no, no. It would be nice if that's the case. So 27 years as a monk, and many of those years, 8 years here, very good monk, very, very popular in Thailand, and now he's going on a tour of Australia for a month, teaching in many countries. But he starts off here in Perth to share the Dhamma with us, and a wonderful teacher, and again in charge of many monks, and three or four monasteries over in Thailand, and very well worthwhile listening to. So I introduced Hajjanyana to give a talk on the Dhamma on whatever subject he likes this evening. Are you right in?
Thank you for the introduction, Dhanajan Brahmongso. I will begin the talk by the traditional Buddhist chanting of paying respects to the Buddha, the Noble One, the Enlightened One, fully enlightened by himself. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. Now this evening I really didn't plan a talk to give to you. I thought, well, whatever comes up. And from Ajahn Brahmawongso's introduction to me a few moments ago, he spoke about seeking freedom for democracy and then deciding that that wasn't the way and it's better to seek freedom within oneself. I thought that I would carry on that theme about seeking freedom within oneself. Many years ago, before I actually went to stay with Ajahn Chah, there was a Western monk who became a very famous writer much later on, his name was Jack Cornfield, and he became a monk with Ajahn Chah. And when he went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, he found it very difficult because it was so regimented. We all shaved our heads, we all wore the same colored robes, we had the same bowls, we went on alms round at exactly the same time, we got up at the same time in the morning, we did chores all together. And he had been a hippie before coming to a monastery, and had an idea of freedom being doing what you want, when you want, how you want, at all times. And so he felt very frustrated, and he said that one night he had a dream where he took his monk's bowl, simple plain monk's bowl, and painted technicolor colors all over the monk's bowl, and tie-dyed his robe. And he woke up in a hot sweat because he thought he'd be in trouble by Ajahn Chah. And so he walked off to Ajahn Chah's hut and thought, you know, this is just too much. I'm too restricted with all these particular rules of training and all these ways of doing things together with all the monks. I want some space. And he went to Ajahn Chah and said, look, these regiment rules are not the way. I think we need more freedom, more space to do what we want, when we want, how we want. And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, see if you can find a more profound state of freedom than that. And those words just knocked all his thoughts out of his head. He was completely taken back and stilled by that. Because then Ajahn Chah said, do you think that real freedom is just getting what you want, how you want, and when you want it? You've done that in your life to a certain degree, and has it brought you real freedom? Maybe there's a more profound state of freedom than that. And he was so taken back by that, he went back to his kuti and he realized that actually, yes, it's not just doing what we want or following our desires that brings us freedom, because we've, in our own life experience, have all noticed that actually sometimes that doesn't bring us freedom, it brings us problems, difficulties, enjoyment sometimes, pleasures, but consequences as a result of those pleasures. And maybe there is a higher state, a more profound state of freedom than following desire. And that brought him back to the fundamental teachings of the Buddha, which was that yes, there is a state of freedom, which he called enlightenment, nibbana, liberation, and that isn't achieved through following desire, but through the cultivation of overcoming desire and abandoning desire, then that real freedom can be obtained. And that real freedom is through developing body, speech and mind as a pathway. And the profundity of the Buddha's teachings that I found in my life, when people ask me, what really brought you to Buddhism? What was the thing? And especially in Thailand, people see you as a Western monk, you know, brought up in a Western culture, not brought up as a Buddhist, and then coming to discover Buddhism and then becoming a monk. They say, well, what brought you to Buddhism? And I always give the response that really the one thing that struck me that brought me to Buddhism was the Noble Eightfold Path. Because in the Buddha's teachings, as we know, he taught this, the first noble truth, the noble truth that life is basically unsatisfactory because it's always changing. Doesn't matter how pleasurable it will get, that pleasure will change and disappear. And I tend to simplify that definition that life is unsatisfactory as saying, life is problematic. Because when we hear this, that life is suffering or dukkha or unsatisfactory, it gets a bit abstruse. But when we say that life is problematic, we can start to see that yes, as soon as we wake up in the morning, there's a problem there. Do we get up or do we, you know, turn on the snooze button? Ajahn Brahm gave me an alarm clock and I noticed there's a big snooze button there. He says it's compassion. I say that's indulgence. He should ban all snooze buttons on his monks' clocks in his monastery. And we see that there's immediate problem there. When we get up, there's the problems of taking care of the body, brushing the teeth, combing the hair if you've got any. You know, just cleaning up the body, preparing it for the day, then feeding the body, then putting the body to work in useful employment so that you can keep this life going. And all the problems and difficulties that go with employment, work, the boss, the employees, then relatives and friends, problems of loved ones, the problems of money and economy, the problems of health and well-being, all the problems of life that come through the door to us. So life is about having a strategy, a skillful strategy for overcoming problems. And having a skillful strategy for overcoming problems is where wisdom comes into life. How wise we are will reflect in our skillful strategy for dealing with the problems of life, dealing with the dukkha of life, so to speak, in Pali. And this dealing with the problems of life is how we tackle the first noble truth, the noble truth of change, creating unsatisfactoriness, problems. And the second noble truth is, the Buddha pointed out, as we know, that there is a cause for problems, and that is our desires. Someone asked me, how long are you staying here in Perth? And I said, I'll be staying till Wednesday. And immediately said, that's not long enough. And my response was the response that Ajahn Chah would give. Is the piece of string too long or too short? If I have a piece of string this long and you want a piece of string longer than this, then it's too short. If you want a piece of string shorter than this, then it's too long. The problem is not the piece of string, it's what you want. So how long I'm staying in Perth is not a problem unless you want more or less. Some people might want less. When I told the people in Thailand I was going to be away for a month, they said, that's too long. So we can see that it's what we desire. So that is the cause of problems. That's where our problems and difficulties are sourced from, is because of our either wanting it to be longer or shorter, and better or worse, come or go, to have or to get rid of. So that wanting and rejecting causes problems. And then, of course, the Buddha said, there's a utopia, there's Nibbana. Now, for myself, when I came across Buddhism, it sounded a wonderful thing, Nibbana, and it's certainly desirable, but it is far from our experience here and now, and it is something to aspire to, but it is distant. It's not something yet that we have experienced or can directly know when we certainly begin. And most religions offer you a utopia. So that didn't really grab me. But the thing that grabbed me about Buddhism was that he taught a strategy to realize that utopia of freedom, the Noble Eightfold Path. And it was that strategy that was presented very systematically and very clearly that grabbed me, because I thought, well, if he's saying that this is what he did to realize freedom, and he's saying that if you follow these procedures, this strategy, you too can realize freedom, then that is something I can put to use. That's something I can try. That's an experiment that I can repeat. So that is what got me hooked. So when people ask, what brought you to Buddhism? It's that, the strategy in life for overcoming all problems and leading to that freedom. And the Buddha taught that there is freedom to be found through the Noble Eightfold Path, and he divided that up into basically three things, that is virtue, the path of virtue, the path of meditation, and the path of wisdom. So the eight steps are divided up into those three basic categories. And the area of virtue is a strategy for becoming a more kind, skillful, compassionate person. And we can see that as a strategy for overcoming problems, it actually does reduce problems. We just intellectually, we can understand that, you know, if people in this world, say, had the virtue of harmlessness and non-killing, non-violence, didn't steal from each other, there wasn't sexual exploitation, and people were honest in their speech and had integrity in their speech, truthfulness, and then were sober and clarity in their minds, then a lot of worldly problems would fade away. So just intellectually we can see the strategy of virtue is a life strategy worthy of taking up, which will overcome many problems socially and also in our own states of existence, our own experience. Our lives will become more peaceful, be free of certain dangers. And here we can see that problems can be overcome by avoiding certain things, certain actions, which will cause more problems. Because problems in life are there, but we don't have to go and find problems. There is a general tendency, certainly when I was a young man, that one should have as many experiences in life as possible. And the broader and the greater, the more diverse your experiences, then the wiser you'll become. And so a lot of things were put down and justified because it's experience. Actually, that's not the Buddhist path. And just because it's an experience doesn't necessarily make it a wise experience. I certainly did many things that were good experiences, but now when I look back, it wasn't so wise because the consequences didn't bring peace to myself or peace to others. And so we can see that actually just the searching for experience, we have to have wisdom. There are certain experiences to avoid, certain environments to avoid, certain situations to avoid, certain places to avoid. As a Buddhist monk, there's certain places in Perth I will avoid. And if you catch me there, you won't be impressed. Why? Because one realizes that there's dangers in that place. That's why they have red lights. It says danger. So part of our training is not to be colorblind. Yes? Yes? You have to be aware that there is red. Avoid it. That area, that situation, that environment does not lead to the growth of peace, virtue, and understanding. The so-called temptations of life. And some people, the red light should go on when they pass the fridge. Yes. That's a red light district for you. But I can't comment on that because people are saying I've put on a lot of weight since I've been in Thailand, so I should be careful on what I say. We can see that we can get ourselves into difficult situations if we don't avoid certain environments, don't encourage our children to avoid certain environments. You know, one of the things of adults who are teaching our children where there's danger, where it's safe to go, where it's safe to travel, who it's safe to be with. Because what we want them to do is have freedom from danger. So there's certain freedoms which lead to more peace. And certain, the freedoms to follow desire sometimes does not lead to peace. It leads to problems. It leads to conflict. And it can lead to great pain and suffering. So having that awareness of areas to avoid. And so some unwholesome states can be overcome just by avoidance. I've commented on this before. I read an experiment where in America they watched how many hours children watch television, and then they watched the average movie, and they saw that in the average movies there was X number of murders in a movie, and then they multiplied that by the average number of hours a person watches from the age of 0 to 20, and they calculated that the average person saw 20,000 murders on television by the time they reached 20 years old. Now, what does that have, and what does that do to this mind of ours, which is a very sensitive, very delicate thing, which is influenced and conditioned by what we feed into it? So by avoiding, by purposely choosing to say, you know, if they'd seen 20,000 acts of compassion, maybe there would be a different response in our societies. But when we're feeding and grandizing violence in society, then we see that there is consequences, a result. And so avoiding certain things which will bring up anger, which will bring up selfishness, which will bring up greed, which will bring up confusion, is skillful behavior, is wise behavior, is a wise strategy, the Buddha said. And when we develop, say, virtuous behavior, harmlessness, integrity, honesty, truthfulness, virtue, and clarity, sobriety, then we're developing these qualities which are not only compassionate to ourselves, but compassionate to others. Give happiness to ourselves and give great happiness to others. And then the Buddha said that there's actually another strategy which is very important in developing to ourselves and others, is that there's certain qualities that we should be abandoning. When we notice within ourselves that unwholesome qualities arise, for example, aversion, negativity, jealousy, rivalry, competition, self-righteousness, greed, exploitation, taking advantage of others or the situation, confusion, doubt, worry, anxieties, and then those are the qualities that we should be striving, developing a strategy in our life to abandon. So what are our wise strategies for abandoning these states? And that is where we do use, say, meditation, mental development, acts of kindness and generosity as a purposeful strategy in life to overcome these states. And one actually has to ask oneself, well, what is my strategy in life? What is my ways of acting and behaving in life? What are my goals? What are my purposes? This evening I was speaking to two different people who I've known at this Buddhist society, and both of them, one of them is in the nursing profession and the other one is wishing to enter the nursing profession. And I was speaking to some nurses in Thailand at one of the major hospitals there. And I spoke to them about right intention as a strategy when they come to work. Because, you know, the nursing profession and many other professions is a profession based in compassion. And a lot of people go into that profession because they want to be carers. They want to help other beings be relieved from physical and mental suffering. And the desire to help other beings to be relieved from physical and mental suffering is a very noble intention and very noble desire, which brings a lot of people into that profession. But after a time, the intention to help sentient beings be freed from physical, mental suffering fades away, and one goes to work thinking, is it payday today? And so the noble quality shifts into the background, and one wonders whether one is going to get the promotion one deserves. One thinks one deserves is going to be able to avoid the person one doesn't like at work, or one is going to have to deal with a problematic patient or whatever. Whereas if one is going to work, establishing the moment that one heads off to work is, my intention today is to help beings overcome physical and mental pain, then one is creating wholesome action, wholesome intention, a wholesome goal. And so the job becomes a part of your spiritual path. It becomes a life strategy, a life goal. Your goal is aiming for the helping and assisting of the relieving of suffering in others. And also you get paid for it. You don't have to worry about that. If you enjoy your job, you end up doing a good job usually. If you put your heart into your job, you usually end up doing a better job. And so it's that, having that intention there, which is very important. And all of our lives, we can wake up in the morning and establish that wholesome intention as part of our life strategy. This is the goal, this is the purpose, this is the direction, this is the aim of my life. To incline in giving not only myself freedom from suffering, but other beings freedom from suffering. And we can overcome these hindrances, these difficulties in life by abandoning those things that are unskillful. One of the stories I told last time I was here, I'm going to repeat it because I see that there's actually many new people here. And it's a very powerful story because I've used it a lot when speaking with people who are sick. And it's a story of a true story of an old monk who is, I think, the oldest monk in the world. He's 113. He's still alive. He lives in Phuket in Thailand. His name is Lumpu Supa. And he has had quite a marvelous and adventurous life. And he told the Western monks about a time when he was meditating in a cave. He'd sat and walked meditation all day. It was late in the night. And 2 a.m, he was getting tired, so he decided to lay down and rest. So he laid down mindfully to rest and fell asleep and woke up feeling very strange pain in his legs. So he lit a candle and looked down at his legs, and a huge python was swallowing him and had swallowed him up to his knees. and it was continuing to swallow him. And he said to the python, "Wait a minute, snake. Before you swallow me, I just want to say something to you. If this is how I must die, then I give this body to you. Because I will die, and if I have to die as your food, then I give this body to you. But I'm determined that this heart, this mind, goes to Nibbana, to enlightenment. And I've determined to use this life to practice for enlightenment, for ultimate freedom. If you eat this body, snake, you have to take this mind to Nibbana, to enlightenment, to freedom." At that, the snake regurgitated him and slithered out the cave. Now, most of you probably will not be eaten by a python in your life, unless you come to my monastery, because I released 10 of them in the monastery. That's to keep the monks awake at night. We don't have snooze buttons on the monk, on the clocks in the monks in our monastery. So those people who told me this evening that they'd love to come and stay in my monastery, you're most welcome. But just remember the pythons. And you may not ever wake up in the middle of the night and find a python swallowing you. But I met a number of people this evening and today who told me that they had cancer. That is your python. And all of us at some stage in our life are going to go to the doctors and he says, "I'm sorry, you're being swallowed by old age, sickness, a disease, and death will follow." And you say, "That's very fine, doctor. I don't mind if cancer is going to eat this body up because this mind is determined to go to freedom. I give this body to the cancer, but you must take this mind to Nibbana." That is using the wisdom of this old monk. And that's a very, very powerful life strategy. Because when the problem, the real serious problem of our impermanence, our mortality, is there and presents us, we can face that with an ultimate goal. That's fine. We don't have to faint. We don't have to worry. We say, "Ah, cancer, if you have to eat this body, I give this body to you. But you have to take this mind to enlightenment. You might find that that cancer will suddenly get scared and regurgitate you, just like the old monk. But regardless, you have a life strategy, taking yourself to an ultimate purpose, an ultimate goal, and using your skill and wisdom in life to fulfill that goal, that purpose. And then that takes me to the next point that the Buddha said, there is certain things for overcoming unwholesome states of mind which we need to develop. And the way we overcome unwholesome qualities, you know, the things that we don't like in ourselves, is to develop the things we respect in ourselves and others, the qualities that we respect. And this is how we take up the process of, I respect people who are good and noble. How can I then become more wholesome and noble myself? And one way is by associating with the good and the noble, by reading about it, by trying to raise the mind up to do the good and the noble. Because that's when we're really challenged, isn't it? Because our wisdom is something that we need to use when we're challenged, when we're tested. You know, the difficult colleague at work, the colleague from hell, that's our challenge sometimes. How do we respond to them? How do we deal with them? Do we get lost in the blaming, the judging, the criticism? Or do we use this to rise up and conquer ourselves? There's a beautiful story in the Discourse of the Buddha which gives you an idea of this. The story of Mahakasapa. And in a previous life, he had been born as a very poor man. And he was married to a lady who was also very poor. And between them, they just had two pieces of cloth. They each had a sarong or a shawl to cover the lower part of their body. But they only had one piece of cloth between them to cover the upper part of their body. And in India at that time, you didn't go into society unless you covered your upper part of your body. And so he could go out into the fields and work, but he couldn't go into the town. And one time, the Buddha Kassapa, previous Buddha, was giving teachings, and they loved, both of them loved to go and listen to Dhamma talks. But they knew that it would be inappropriate to go and listen to Dhamma talks just with the shawl. So what they had to do was divide their time. During the day, the wife would go to the monastery and she would wear her sarong and take the one piece of cloth and cover her upper part of her body and listen to the Dhamma talk, and then come home and then give the shawl to her husband, and he would go in the evening. And that way they listened to the Dhamma. And one time it was around the Katina time, which is a time of traditionally offering cloth to the monks at the end of the rains. And the husband went to the monastery and he was listening to a talk and was hearing that it was a time for offering cloth at the end of the rains retreat. And the king was intending to offer some cloth. And he found he was inspired. He wanted to do an act of generosity. And he felt incredible hunger to do a generous act because he was so poor. He had so little to share. And he thought, well, I've only got this one piece of cloth. And if I give that up, that's going to create great problems for myself and my wife. But I really want to give that. And so his mind was in this conflict, in this turmoil. Should I give or shouldn't I? And in the end, after going back and forth in his own mind many times, thinking of the problems that it caused, he made a determination. Even though my wife's not here, may she, when I tell her that I've sacrificed this cloth, rejoice in this act of generosity, so that we can build merit together, make happiness together for now and in the future. And he took that piece of cloth off his shoulders, put it on his head, and then placed it on the feet of Kassapa Buddha. And at the time of placing it on the feet of Kassapa Buddha, he yelled out, "I have conquered, I have victored. I have won victory." And the king was a bit taken back and said, "What are you talking about? You know, you've offered this old piece of cloth to this monk. Why are you yelling out, 'I have conquered, I have victored'?" And he said, "I have conquered my own mind, my own desires, my own fears. I have given up and sacrificed what is for me hard to sacrifice. And therefore I have had victory over myself, my own desires." And then the king was so impressed by that, he told his ministers to bring the silk from the palace, and he gave it to that man and then hired him because of his integrity as one of his workers in the palace. And so the family actually were in a much more comfortable situation than before. And I love that story because it actually points to the heart of Buddhism, is that to conquer oneself is the hardest victory, isn't it? Our own fears, our own desires, our own negativity and anger, but that is the ultimate victory. And so this is what we mean by certain things must be developed, is that we can say, "I have conquered, I have won. I haven't beaten the other person in the game of life. I've beaten all my unwholesome qualities. I have found freedom from them." And if we can call out that victory, can you, and this is the ultimate test, I think, say at the end of life, "I have had victory, I have had conquered all the difficulties, the problems of life that life has presented me." And if we can do that, then we've found real freedom. And this is actually a very important factor of the path of Buddhism, is not finding, conquering, or overcoming what other people say, but finding that we can overcome the problems that present within our own minds and our own lives and our own hearts. That is very important. And the other thing that the Buddha said that we need to do in the path is actually sustain the good qualities that we've already developed. And this is often the hardest part, because sometimes we can, be virtuous for a while, but to be virtuous all the time, that's a real test. Sometimes we can be peaceful for a while, but to be peaceful steadily, evenly, to be calm and contented throughout life situations and challenges, that is the real test. Sometimes we can be wise in certain occasions and then trip up in others. And so it's to sustain the good qualities that we've already developed. That is another strategy of life. That should be part of our strategy, our way of dealing with life, is what are the good qualities that I have developed? And then saying, well, these need to be protected. It's just like your children, or a very delicate plant. Those things need care, they need protection, they need sensitivity to be looked after and supported so that they can nurture and grow. And so too, the qualities we've developed in our minds, in our hearts, they need a lot of care and attention to nurture and grow, and so that we can sustain them, keep them maturing, developing, and growing. And that's why building, a physical place like this is one of the supports for allowing This Buddhist center allows people to develop the minds and develop the hearts. The physical buildings are structures that give convenience to supporting the mind. But the most important thing here tonight is not the building, the material things outside, it's all the hearts of the people sitting here. And the qualities, the virtues, the goodness in those hearts. And so instead of, for example, looking around this room and seeing the physical bodies sitting in this room, try to look around the room and look for the shining hearts. Look at not as a person, as a physical person. This person is a Buddhist monk. This person is a man or a woman. This person is an adult or a child, old or young. This person is of this nationality. But this person is a heart. This is a mind which is seeking happiness and wishing to avoid unhappiness and suffering. And how can I support that mind in this being and the mind of other beings to grow in happiness, grow in kindness, grow in nobility and goodness and care, to be wise and skillful and mindful, and to avoid those traps, those dangers in life that will lead to the opposite? How can I sustain the goodness within my life? And one of the things that the forest meditation monks will often stress to lay people is the rarity of being born as a human being. Just being born in the human realm is not difficult. There's 6 billion of us. But to be born amongst humanity is actually very difficult. To be human, that means to have humanity. And to have humanity means to be ethical, to be compassionate, which means having the qualities of mind that gives humanity to a human body. We have this human body, but we have to make it a mind based in qualities of humanity, which are the qualities of compassion, kindness, goodness, ethics, virtue, sincerity, truthfulness, honesty. They are the qualities that make us human. And those qualities we can grow and develop and sustain within ourselves so that they prosper, they mature. And to do that, firstly we have to treasure what we already have. If we're actually heedless about the goodness that we have, about the good qualities we have, the good situation we have, then we get very careless. That is why the Buddha said, carelessness or heedlessness is the door to continuous death. You die as a human person because you couldn't care. One becomes heedless about the qualities of humanity. But when one cares, one is careful, then that is a door to the deathless, the Buddha said. So heedfulness is a door to the deathless. One doesn't die. That is not that the being doesn't die, but it leads this mind of ultimate freedom, and that freedom never dies. So one time I remember I was at Wat Bopong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and I was a newly ordained monk. And been in the monastery for about a year then. You had one meal a day. And in the afternoons there was nothing else apart from water. And most of the food I wasn't used to. And the food at Wapapong was pretty awful. Achin Brom can reassure you on that. That's why we're making up for both of us now. And I remember and the monks would hand out the food. You'd never get to choose. If you go up to Bodhinyana Monastery, some of the lay people said, "I never eat as good as this." They see the food that's offered to the monks is incredible in this particular country and in this society. And the food at Wapapong, you never chose. It was so little and so bad, it had to be given to you, handed out to you. So you would sit with your bowl in front of you, and a monk would come down the line, and he would put a lump of something in your bowl. And I remember one monk commenting, there was a fish dish, and someone put a scoop of this grey, mushy fish dish in his bowl, which stunk. And his comment was, "I've seen better stuff in a bait shop." But it gives you a bit of a feeling of what it was like. So at the time of handing out the food, there was a bit of tension, because you didn't know what you're going to get. And sometimes you got exactly what you want, but then someone would come along with a big pot of chili and plonk it right on top of everything else. So there was always a bit of tension, and I didn't realize that I was one of the tense monks as well. And I remember one monk, I always remember this because it really broke the tension. He came down the line and he stood in front of me, and as he lifted the spoon up to put something in my bowl, which actually I wanted, he said very softly to me, "See if you can find freedom from this." That was the best meal I've ever had, because it was food for the heart. Because what he did was hit me for a six. Yes, actually, food is just food. There must be something higher than this, something that leads to a greater freedom. And this is what the Buddha said when he was reflecting after his enlightenment. He reflected on the Dhamma that he'd realized. And he said, very powerful words, he said, "This teaching is for the abandonment of all accumulations," which means, see if you can find freedom from all you've got. What do you accumulate? It's not just material things of the house, the car, the possession, but it's even people, relationships, ideas, thoughts, feelings, disappointments. They're all things that have accumulated in our lives, in our life experience, and sometimes we've accumulated it so much we're afraid to give it away, give it up, because we think it is going to bring us happiness, just like that spoon of the dish that the monk was going to put in the bowl. I thought that was going to give me happiness. See if we can find something that gives more freedom than that. And the things that give more freedom than that is the pathway of virtue, of meditation and wisdom. They incline us to free us up from our attachments, from our fears, from our desires. And when they free us up from them, then we feel unburdened. We're putting down things, letting go of things, putting them aside. And there is more space and freedom there. So life is not about accumulating things. It's about finding a higher freedom than that. And that freedom has been pointed out, and the way to that freedom has been pointed out by those people who obtain that freedom, that is, the enlightened ones of the present and the past. And so this evening, I have come to the Buddhist Society. I am very moved to be able to come back and see all of you again, meet with you, and I greet you again. And I would like to give these words of Dhamma so that it can support and help you in your life and in your practice. Thank you. Ajahn Brahm asked for me to request, is there any questions? Ajahn Brahm said it fits in the donation box, but I won't do that. our treasurer does. That's actually that's a very good question, and it's a very important question for especially for the lay people. You know, the monks don't actually have money, but we use facilities. And you know, I get this question asked very frequently, even in a Buddhist country in Thailand, and so it's very important here. So I certainly want to give some time to responding to that question. The Buddha himself was not telling all his disciples to abandon wealth. Very interestingly, he actually taught all levels of society, and some of his greatest supporters were actually the kings of the time. And he didn't tell them you have to become monks and throw away your wealth or give it all away. Some of the other people were the aristocracy and some of the most wealthy people at that time. For example, Anadipindika was one of the wealthiest laymen in Sawati. And Visakha was one of the really wealthy lay women. And so they were multimillionaires, but they were disciples of the Buddha who had come and listened to their talks and had immense faith in him. He spoke about wealth as one should accumulate wealth for one's own happiness and for the happiness of others. And one should accumulate wealth which does not exploit oneself or exploit others. So it has to be rightly obtained wealth, wholesomely obtained wealth, that one can go to sleep at night reflecting at how have I obtained this? Has it exploited other beings? Am I fair to others? And is that wealth obtained through honest, skillful, wholesome means? And so that sort of wealth is praiseworthy. But what he did say is one should use that wealth. And he actually gave a whole discourse on about how to wisely use wealth. And one of the things he said is one should obtain one's money and wealth and put some aside for reinvestment. One should put some aside for one's material needs and clothing and family and things like that. Some should be put aside for when problems arise, security, health insurance. They didn't have in that days, but he said put it aside to bank it. And then some should be used for charity, acts of charity, philanthropy. And that's where Ajahn Brahm was talking about the donation box, that section of your wealth. And so, you know, he was telling how to use people to use wealth skillfully, but also he's saying that, you know, some people find it, they can obtain wealth, but they can't keep it. That's unwise as well. You know, some people earn great amounts of money, but they can't save, they can't keep that money or use it for skillful means because they haven't learned how to use money. I have a layman at my one of my monasteries who used to earn huge amounts of money, but basically he has spent it all on drinking and gambling. And so he's broke now, and so he's decided to come and stay in a Buddhist monastery. And you know, that someone can obtain wealth and keep it and spend it skillfully, but then they don't know how to share it as well. So it brings them happiness, but doesn't necessarily benefit any other people. And so that is another aspect of using wealth. So it's not that, certainly wealth is not bad in Buddhism at all. And as I said, many wealthy people were disciples, enlightened disciples, the first stage of enlightenment, the Sotapannas at the time of the Buddha. But it's how we obtain that wealth, how we use that wealth, which is the most essential thing about wealth. Because really, the things we've obtained from the world are just temporary possessions of ours. We all know the saying, we can't take it with us. But really, can we get our minds around that? Really, it is only just passing through our hands. Maybe the government will take it off us. Maybe our children will get it. It's actually how skillfully we've obtained that wealth and then how skillfully we use that wealth. And I, as an abbot, Ajahn Brahm as well, reflect on this very often, that yes, finances donated to the monasteries, and as sometimes we don't need those donations, how can I use those donations in a way which is respectful of how and the intentions of the donor, but also of being benefit to society. So, for example, when I get back to Thailand, I'm going to be laying a road in the local school using monastery funds, because I went every birthday. I go to the school and give out gifts. I gave out computers last year for the school because that's what they wanted, and the teachers complained that the local school is a swamp in the rainy season, and the kids have to walk through the mud and they get athlete's foot and things like that. And so this year, I spoke to the teacher's headmaster before coming here and said, look, I want to get the whole village out there. The monastery will pay for all the gravel and the sand and the cement, and we'll pour a road and pathways for the kids in the school. And some people argued with me in the village. They said, just bring in a concrete truck, it's much quicker. But I said, no, I don't want a quick road. I want a harmonious road. I want the whole village to come out and put some work on Saturday and Sunday afternoon
and mix the cement. I don't care if the road is not quite as strong up to engineer grade cement. What I care about is the whole village and the monastery do something together for the children of the village. And that will bring harmony in the village and bring the society together. And that's a much better road in the school. And so it's actually how we use the wealth and what we use it for, which is very important. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. It's purely voluntary, and when I suggested it, the response has just been overwhelming. Because in the Thai society, the village society is very different from a large city. That the villagers are used to doing things as a communal group, but now, as in that particular village. People are going off and doing jobs everywhere else. That part is breaking down. The village life is starting to get more individualistic. And so when I suggested this, their response was just overwhelmingly in favor of it and very supportive, because they want those sort of projects that brings the village together. If no one turns up, I don't care, but I'll get the monks out doing it. Then they might say that's exploitive, but if they don't do it, I'll bring more pythons to the monastery. I just on that, one of the monks sitting next to me actually went to that school. This is Tan Tejin. He actually is from the monastery. I go on alms round every day, and actually went to that school. And so when we went back there, you could see that the school had been built, 40 years, and it was still in an impoverished state. And he was actually telling me, when he was a young boy, his mother was a very devout supporter of our monastery when we first went there. And he was telling me that the monks in the morning would go on alms round into the village. And it was tradition in the old days when he was a young boy that any food that was cooked for breakfast, the rice, would not be eaten by the householders until they'd actually put food in the monks' bowls. And so his mother, who was very devout, used to cook rice, and then he used to be very hungry and want to eat the rice, and she would say, "No, you have to wait for the monks to come." And so he'd be very excited to watch to see that the monks came on time and keeping an eye out. And when the monks would get close to the village, he'd get very excited and say, "The monks have come, the monks have come." And then the family would come out and put rice in the monks' bowls, and then they would go in and have a meal together, because they had the feeling that they should start the day doing act of generosity, which is a wonderful tradition. So that's now changing. When I go into the village nowadays, all the kids are watching Japanese cartoons on television.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Bhutang Bhagavantang Abhivate Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.